This is PCJ Radio International.
Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Coming up on today's program, what's behind all the rhetoric from North Korea? Has China's influence on the DPRK waning? And new outcome at the International Forum on People Smuggling in Bali, Indonesia. So stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Well, for the past couple of months now, North Korea has been in the headlines around the world a number of times. It started first with their rocket launch, their nuclear test, and now a lot of rhetoric coming out of the DPRK saying that they want war because they have unfinished business with the United States, South Korea, and other countries that were fighting during the Korean War. They've done away with the armistice agreement, and they've also cut communications between North and South Korea. Now, many people would say, well, we've seen this all before. This is just North Korea acting like a little child, screaming, wanting to get attention. But is it more than that? Well, to find out and discuss this situation, we're now joined by Christopher Green. He's the manager of international affairs at the Daily NK website based in Seoul.
In 1997, a former member, high member of the North Korean government, defected to the South, Hwang Jang-yop, quite a famous man. And at that time, I was working at Cambridge University, and I had access to some literature which was about his defection, and it inspired me to seek more information on North Korea. So that really it sort of incited my interest in the country back in the beginning.
Now, just like myself, you've also had an opportunity to go to North Korea. And when people ask me what it's like, the only thing I can think of saying is that it is a very surreal experience.
It is a surreal experience, yes. The first time I went there, I didn't speak much Korean. And I think not speaking any Korean made it more surreal. I would say it became less surreal the following times because I had more of an awareness of what was going on around me. But that doesn't take away all the surreal nature of the place. Obviously, it's spent 60 years diverging from what I would call the norm of states, and the results are there for all to see.
Now, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the propaganda coming out of North Korea being turned up. Now, I can't think of any other time in history, even during the days of the Cold War with the Soviet Union using that same kind of propaganda. It just seems that with North Korea, a lot of people are saying right now with what they're doing is just them doing their usual thing, like a spoiled child wanting attention. Would you agree with people that are saying that? Or is there something more serious here?
Fundamentally, I would agree with people saying that, but I think there are other issues that need to be taken into account, such as the new young leader phenomenon, the need for him to assert his strength and dominance over the polity. All of these things do contribute. Of course, there's also the problem that, as you know very well, North Korea has been playing this same game for quite a long time, and as with all games where you don't follow through on your threats, you are subject to the law of diminishing returns, and I think that may be a part of it as well. So there's a coagulation of multiple factors at this point.
Now, Chris, with all the propaganda that we've seen, obviously this is targeting a North Korean public, but it seems that so many people are worried in the West, which seems kind of odd since North Korea has a history of doing this. Why are people so, especially in the West, so concerned about all these really strong statements that are coming out of the North?
In the context of South Korea, at least, I think it's because they have a lot to lose. So it's worth them being concerned by the rhetoric. But equally, people in the US or perhaps in Western Europe, maybe they don't follow North Korea that closely. And they instinctively presume that some of what the North Koreans are saying must be rooted in fact. You have to be watching quite closely to feel unconcerned by the rhetoric that comes from Pyongyang. And of course, that's part of the point, because if nobody cared, which would perhaps be the ideal situation, then there'd be no point doing it.
Just the other day, I was speaking to a professor at Tsinghua University in China, And he said to me that this is a bit of a dangerous game going on right now, because he said what could happen is, he said, Western governments and even South Korea or even Japan could read this stuff the wrong way. And, you know, it's the kind of situation where, you know, it just takes one shot to be fired to cause a problem.
Yes, there is the risk of miscalculation. I would agree. These games are always dangerous. North Korea has never played the game the safe way. So from that perspective, yes, I think there is value in those words.
Now, with the information that Daily NK is getting out of North Korea, how do they view Kim Jong-un? Do they view him the same way as his father and his grandfather? Or do they look at him with, a little bit more skepticism?
I think they certainly look at him with a certain degree of skepticism, but that's precisely the problem that the propaganda wonks in Pyongyang have been working to try and change. We have to understand that the North Korean people, of course, didn't view Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il the same way at all. They viewed Kim Il-sung in an infinitely more preferable light overall. But since Kim Jong-un came to power, there have been periods of attempting to make the public expectant, to raise expectations in them that something is going to happen, that the economic situation is going to improve. But there have also been periods of crackdown, which have made people very cynical. So at the time of writing, I would say that the North Korean people still aren't quite sure what to expect, because Kim Jong-un's only been in power for a little bit more than a year. It's not a long time to make value judgments on his rule, is it?
Considering that he's only been there a year and he is so young, do you think that he, like his father, would have the same amount of control? Or are there other people behind the scenes, some generals and some other high-up party officials in the Workers' Party, who are the ones really pulling the strings?
Oh, I think it's absolutely inevitable that there is a committee rule going on at this point. Of course, we all know about Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Jong-hee. She's clearly an important power broker there. We also know about her husband, Jang Song-taek. I mean, these names are all in the public domain. We don't know exactly the combinations and the power structure, but we do know that they're all working together.
If you had a crystal ball, would you just look at the situation and think that it's all going to blow over? Or how long can they really keep up with this rhetoric? Because now they've put the military on standby. They've cut off communications with the South through the hotline. And just today, we saw them turning away South Koreans to the economic zone that they were jointly cooperating with. It's just another step. And that at some point, they're just going to say, you know, everything will just go back to normal. Because I'm wondering here, if they're saying all this stuff, how can they say that they were victorious over something if nothing happens?
That's a very good point. I think they can basically spin any kind of step back on the part of the South Korean government, for example, as a victory. So I don't think that's necessarily a problem. The propaganda people in Pyongyang are extremely resourceful and have been for 60 years. If I had a crystal ball, and alas, I do not, I would suggest that Kim Il-sung's birthday, the anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday, is on the 15th of April, and it's not customary to maintain this level of military tension through that type of event. I think they will want to change the game by then. Equally, in 2009, when the North Koreans last threatened the Kaesong Industrial Complex, they did so for about 3 days. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the law of diminishing returns is in effect, so perhaps we might be looking at 4 or 5 days, but I do think that by the 15th, something will have to change. Whether it be temporary or permanent, I don't know. That would depend on the actions of outside actors like the government in Seoul and Washington. But I do think that things will have to loosen up a bit by then.
Now, we've seen a lot of strange things happen with North Korea lately, and I want to talk about South Koreans for a moment. I mean, just a few weeks ago, they saw the former NBA star Dennis Rodman at a basketball match in Pyongyang with Kim Jong-un. And then, of course, Dennis Rodman is making some statements. He's my friend and all these other things. And now they're seeing this. How do South Koreans see this?
South Koreans are quite sanguine, aren't they? I mean, they've seen this for a long time. Of course, we should remember that the level of North Korea coverage in South Korean newspapers is infinitely higher than in the West, and it covers a broader range of subjects. So I would say that the standard of knowledge of North Korea among South Koreans is instinctively much higher than it is in the West. So yes, as I say, they're more relaxed than perhaps a lot of people in Western countries would be.
One of the fears that some people are having right now, especially if we take, say, China, which is North Korea's closest ally. We've seen the Chinese now getting sort of, enough is enough kind of attitude, beginning to take a stronger issue. A lot of people are saying that China is key to dealing with North Korea. Do you see China as being key to dealing with North Korea?
Yes, I would say that China is probably key to dealing with North Korea. But there's two things to say about that as well. The Chinese have two options. They can keep North Korea going or they can close it down, probably. But there isn't too much nuance in that, is there? Right? You're either providing them with oil or you're not. Mm-hmm. You know. So from that perspective, their range of action is probably more circumscribed than a lot of people would give it credit for. On the flip side as well, we've noticed that although there has been definitely a relaxation of the scale of things that can be said about North Korea and the Chinese media, you can criticize them more now than you probably could 5 years ago if you're a Chinese journalist. But on the other hand, there was one Chinese journalist who wrote a piece for the Financial Times that appears to have overstepped the line, and we heard in just the last few days that he's been removed from his post. So perhaps that was an indication that there is a line in the sand over which journalists should not tread, and perhaps we are asking too much to imagine that the Chinese are going to abandon North Korea at this point in time.
Some people have been suggesting that probably one of the best ways to put all this to rest would be for the U.S. to call North Korea and say, look, we want to talk directly to you. But it just seems that the U.S. At this time, anyway, is unwilling to do that. They want to go back to the six-party talks, which haven't really been that successful. Do you think that Washington should just go directly to North Korea and say, look, we want to talk to you directly and just resolve all these issues?
I don't think it's a good idea to do that at this time, because that just plays into the game that is being played by North Korea. You can't wait for them to raise military tensions to unprecedented heights and then say, okay, we're going to talk to you. That's exactly what they want to happen. Mm-hmm. So no, I wouldn't advocate that course of action at this point in time.
With the South Koreans, I mean, now we have a new president in South Korea. She must be in a bit of an odd situation right now, because she when she was running for president, she said, you know, she wanted to have better dialogue with North Korea.
Yes, but that was a forlorn hope, wasn't it? And I think she was mostly appealing to the South Korean voters who had grown tired of the former president Lee Myung-bak's hardline conservative stance. The South Korean voters' opinion is, broadly speaking, based on whether they are instinctively progressive or conservative. As far as I can tell, it doesn't really have too much to do with their appraisal, objective appraisal of North Korea's actions. Mm-hmm. So Park Geun-hye, the new president, was actually just appealing to the voter base in an attempt to make sure that she kept her vote together, which she obviously did very well. So from that perspective, she was highly successful, and it doesn't really matter what the outcome was because she's now in power.
How much of North Korea as a topic plays into South Korean politics? Is it one of the main issues?
When compared with things like welfare and all the things that concern the middle and low-income families of the world, then no, it's probably not a major issue, but it is one of the major issues on which people can stake their claim to be different. If you're a progressive thinker, a left-wing thinker, then you have a certain perspective on North Korea. And if you're a conservative, you have a different perspective. But you might not necessarily have a different perspective on less polarizing issues. So it's a way for people to distinguish themselves.
The thing that I've always found amazing about the things that North Korea says, especially their propaganda, either from television or their radio broadcast in English and other languages, I wonder sometimes, do they really think that people in the West don't look at this and look at this and go, oh, we understand what they mean? Or do they think, oh, people are looking at this and laughing at us?
I think to an extent they expect people to look at it and find it strange. I think North Korea is very well aware that how it is regarded in the international community, and it seeks to foster the right impression, because North Korea obviously has huge human rights problems, is a heavily militarized society, etc., and so on. And yet in the West, Dennis Rodman maybe makes bigger headlines. Now, is that not a propaganda success for the North Korean regime? I would argue that it is.
Mm-hmm. It's just, when I've seen some of the Just recently, I was watching a documentary that was from North Korean television that was dubbed into English, and it was about not Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Sung.
Kim Il-sung, yes.
Kim Il-sung. And it was the strangest thing because he was an expert in every field imaginable. And it was obviously produced for an overseas audience. And I'm thinking, you know, if people in their propaganda department really think that an overseas audience would go, oh, yeah, he's obviously an intelligent man. He's an expert film director. He's an expert architect. And the strangest line in there was from, because it was a pretty old documentary, was that he's a champion. I still remember the line. He's a champion Olympic swimmer, but because of his duties at home, he could not partake in the Olympic Games. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, how can they say this and think that people will believe them?
Well, I'm not sure they do say them and expect people to believe them. As I say, I think the North Korean propaganda people, I mean, to an extent, they just can't avoid saying those things because these things attain a certain currency. And much like not wanting to be the first person to stop clapping in front of Stalin back in the day, people have to be careful that they keep up with the Joneses on making these statements. They continue to be stated far longer than they have any right to be. But that being said, I don't think too many people actually believe the more extreme ones.
And I was speaking there with Christopher Green, the Manager of International Affairs for the Daily NK website. You can find out more about them by going to www.dailynk.com. Once again, www.dailynk.com. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, staying on the subject of North Korea, in the latest development on the Korean Peninsula, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has ordered the reopening of a nuclear reactor that was closed in 2007. It comes as the South Korea's president warned of a preemptive strike against North Korean nuclear targets if a strike from the North seems imminent. In addition, the United States has diverted the destroyer to the South Korean coast to defend against the possible missile attack as tensions escalate. Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr has called on the world leaders to take the North's threat seriously and will raise the issue during his upcoming visit to China. Beijing, however, no longer appears to have much influence over the renegade on its border. We have this story from Karen Snowden.
The reactor, part of the main Yongbyon nuclear complex, was mothballed in 2007. It was part of the aid for disarmament accord thrashed out in the now failed six-party talks. To quote the North's official news agency, all the facilities are being readjusted and restarted, including a uranium enrichment plant and a 5-megawatt reactor. Daniel Pinkston, Deputy Project Director for Northeast Asia with the International Crisis Group, says the announcement comes as no surprise, but raises nuclear safety issues.
It's an old reactor. It doesn't conform to international safety standards. And of course, it would give them a source of plutonium to make more nuclear bombs.
In what it's calling a prudent move, the U.S. had just hours earlier deployed its destroyer, the Fitzgerald, to South Korea's coast after taking part in annual military exercises with the South's forces, during which B-52s and stealth fighters took part. Yet both the US and South Koreans say there's no evidence of increased military activity or large-scale mobilizations by the North, despite its aggressive threats to target the US. It's a high-stakes standoff, says Dr. Paul Monk, founding director of Austhink Consulting. He says the warning by South Korea's new president, Park Geun-hye, that any provocation by the North will be met with a strong and immediate military response, regardless of the political consequences, sets the two Koreas on a dangerous path.
Very clearly, Park Geun-hye, the South Korean president, is not underestimating it. She's taking it very seriously indeed. And this is really dramatic, and it puts everything on a hair trigger.
Paul Monk is also the former head of China analysis at the Australian Defence Intelligence Organisation. He says the North's actions, including a law passed on Sunday enshrining North Korea's status as a nuclear weapons state, adds to the chance of an accidental escalation to war. But he adds China, although concerned, has its reasons for not pushing hard for change.
China is very critical to this, and although it recently voted in favour of the UN Security Council resolution and sanctions on North Korea, it seems unwilling to put the degree of pressure on North Korea that might break Pyongyang's resolve. And one shouldn't underestimate the difficulty that the Chinese have in dealing with them. You can understand their tentativeness. Strongest China appears relative to North Korea. North Korea is a powder keg and they don't want it to go off. It's right on their doorstep.
The International Crisis Group's Daniel Pinkston says China no longer has much influence on Pyongyang.
China has tried to exert its influence in so many ways, but without success. So, you know, force is the only thing that remains, and China's not going to do that. And despite the displeasure with the North Korean behavior, I don't think China is going to take any extreme actions that would cause instability in North Korea.
Would China's leadership be concerned about the U.S. response so far, especially the diverting of its warship, the USS Fitzgerald, to South Korea's coast as a symbol, if nothing else?
Right. I think China often is concerned not so much directly with North Korea's behavior, but the response to it. So the Chinese government always asks other parties to exercise restraint and not to exacerbate the situation. And they're often concerned about U.S. Reactions and responses. So that's always connected to the Chinese calculus, I think.
I suppose the further it goes, though, the bigger chance there is that with nuclear weapons, there'll be an opportunity or a desire to use them down the track.
Yes, and of course, when you have nuclear weapons, even though the probability is small or remote, there could be a nuclear accident, accidental explosion, unauthorized use. There could be a transfer of a nuclear weapon to other states or non-state actors. So even if those probabilities are low, it's not impossible for such an event to occur, and that would have catastrophic consequences.
There's been a fresh outcome at the International Forum on Tackling Human Trafficking and People Smuggling in Bali, Indonesia. Ministers, including Australia's Minister of Immigration, Brendan O'Connor, the Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, have agreed to set up a working group to bolster effort to stop this problem. It comes as the United Nations agency says it is dealing with a marked increase in the number of people arriving in Indonesia seeking assistance, and says the trend is likely to continue. From Canberra, Australia, we have this report from Karen Barlow.
Cooperation has been the catch cry of the Bali Process ministerial talks on people smuggling, and now more is on the way. The International Forum of more than 40 countries has agreed to set up a working group to stop people trafficking that will work with non-government organisations and businesses. The Bali meeting has also decided to form a partnership with the Transnational Crime Resource, the Jakarta Centre for Law Enforcement Cooperation. The centre is designed to assist the region in counter-terrorism and security responses to issues such as border controls. It's not a major breakthrough, but Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr went into the meeting wanting more cooperation.
There are tens of millions of people in the world who are adrift, homeless, looking for somewhere to go. You need regional cooperation if you're to see that they're to be treated humanely and that borders are respected and that you have an orderly handling of the movement of peoples.
The numbers of boats and asylum seekers heading Australia's way are on the rise. A boat with 81 people on board was intercepted last night off the Cocos Islands. For Australia's Shadow Immigration Minister Scott Morrison, the unseasonal increase in boats over March is proof of failing border protection policies.
We've set a new monthly record at over 2,500 people. In the last week of March, we had more than 1,000 people turn up illegally by boat.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says there's been a significant increase in the number of people coming to Indonesia and registering with its office. It now has more than 7,000 people on its books, and it expects the rise in numbers will continue. Targeting the 40 nations in Bali for the regional summit on people smuggling and trafficking, the UNHCR says Asia-Pacific nations should step up and cooperate. Indonesia wants Australia Australia to take more people. Greens spokeswoman Sarah Hanson-Young says the Indonesians are right.
We've had more boats come in Australia's history than since August 13. We've had more boats come this year than this time last year. The Manus Island, Nauru Detention Centre, the No Advantage Test has been a fundamental failure to stop those boats. We're having more boats, we're still having terrible boat tragedies, and yet all the while there are people desperately waiting to be resettled out of Indonesia.
Australia's Immigration Minister Brendan O'Connor has addressed the Bali summit today as it moved behind closed doors. He talked up Australia's agreement with Nauru and Papua New Guinea and says other Bali process members could potentially be involved. The Shadow Immigration Minister Scott Morrison says the Australian government is just trying to resurrect the Malaysia people swap deal, a deal blocked by the coalition and rejected by the Australian High Court.
What Bob Carr and Brendan O'Connor should be doing in Indonesia this week is getting the focus of the Bali process back on deterrence. It was this Labor government that got the Bali process off track, trying to turn it into a mini UN to accommodate those coming into the region. It shouldn't be doing that. It should be focusing on deterrence policies to prevent people moving into the region, so then that prevents them from getting on a boat and coming to Australia.
But the Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, says that's too simplistic. He says a range of actions is needed to truly stop the boats.
You need action in countries that are generating the flow of people. Afghanistan and Iran have got large refugee numbers, and there have been people recruited by people smugglers from those jurisdictions. You need law enforcement action directed at the people smugglers in interdiction and prosecution. And we've seen progress, we want more.
While in Indonesia, Bob Carr has been talking up the Labor government's ties with its neighbour. The opposition leader has accused the Australian government of trashing the relationship with megaphone diplomacy. But the foreign minister says that's trash talk.
Well, there's no evidence of that. The relationship has never been better.
A big effort is going into Australia's relationship with China. The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, is preparing to leave in days for the most senior Australian delegation ever to go to China. And there's revelations of a special Australian task force on China, headed by the secretaries from all the relevant Australian departments. Turns out this previously secret and unprecedented grouping meets 3 to 4 times a year, and the Department of Foreign Affairs says its existence reflects the breadth and scale of the bilateral relationship.
And with that report from Karen Barlow, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. I'm Keith Powell, saying so long and take care.